Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 115, The Next Steps. So, we are getting ever closer to landing on the moon again, and then on to Mars. That first step could be less than a decade away, while the second step is pretty much science fiction at this stage. Flying astronauts to Mars may be technically feasible, but we're yet to actually build many of the components we'll need to make it happen. But first, let's consider that first step, the moon. Dear Cheap Astronomy, what can we do with lunar regolith? Lunar regolith is readily available for use by space explorers, but just being available doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be useful. Nonetheless, over the many years since Apollo, there have been some interesting suggestions about what to do with it, and now that we are in the Artemis era, this seems a good time to blow the moon dust off some of those suggestions. And speaking of blowing off moon dust, once we start building lunar bases, just landing wherever you like becomes a problem, since retro rocket fire will blow regolith around in large volumes and at high speed and over long distances, since there's no atmosphere to slow it down. This wasn't an issue for Neil and Buzz, but once you have buildings and infrastructure nearby, they won't last long if they're constantly blasted by regolith, which is akin to fine and sharp pieces of glass. We can mostly avoid this problem by building landing pads made of fused regolith. Proposed building methods range from adding a binding agent to your rocket exhaust, so you literally create the landing pad as you land, or you could have robots prepare a landing pad beforehand by sweeping out a flat plane of regolith and then using microwaves to bake it into a solid surface. Or if those options sound a bit radical, you could just lay down a landing pad using regolith-derived pavers. It's widely anticipated that future lunar bases will be built with regolith pavers and regolith bricks, as well as regolith mortar and concrete. It's also sometimes said that such bases will be built from the blood, sweat and tears of astronauts, literally. Blood albumin is apparently a good binding agent, where animal blood was commonly used in early cements on Earth. Also, urea from sweat and tears, and also another salty fluid, yep, urine, can apparently enhance the tensile strength of regolith-based concrete. Mind you, there are at least an equal number of proposed chemical pathways to regolith masonry that don't involve human excretions. What is common to all such procedures is the need for lots of water, a good deal more than could be derived from astronauts, so the use of in situ water ice already on the moon would be required. Something that could cut Earth-Moon transport costs significantly is regolith-based heat shields, which would be carefully shaped blocks of regolith masonry. If the moon does become a base for asteroid mining and refining, you could send and soft land a range of products back on Earth using robotic craft that have regolith heat shields. This would save millions, if not billions, since you wouldn't have to launch those heat shields from Earth. Plus, they would achieve the usual role of heat shields, where Earth's atmosphere is used to aerobrake returning spacecraft rather than wasting fuel on retro rocket burns. And lastly, there are various products we can extract from regolith. Its most abundant element is oxygen, around 40% by mass, another 20% is silicon, then there's around 5% each of iron, aluminium, calcium and magnesium, followed by a range of trace elements at less than 1% each. These trace elements include titanium and also the isotope helium-3, which has a much touted the completely hypothetical role in yet-to-be-invented nuclear fusion generators. But it also has a genuine role in medicine, where it's currently used in some magnetic resonance imaging scanning procedures. Extracting any of these products from raw regolith requires some sophisticated infrastructure, where furnace-level heating and steam injection under high pressure seem to be common processing requirements. It's important to remember that whatever may have been achieved in a laboratory on Earth would need to be scaled up to factory-level production to produce meaningful amounts of the various desired products. And once again, you'd need a lot of water to make it all happen. Whether doing any of this makes economic sense largely depends upon how and why we want to have a sustained presence on the moon. If it's just going to involve a few small bases for scientific research, then a few bricks and pavers might suffice. But if the moon is to become a major hub for solar system resource exploitation and colonization, then all the other stuff would be worth doing as well. And so, as we like to say here at Cheap Astronomy, it's best just to watch this space.
This is the middle bit.
As always, there's a lot of wild speculation about what we might do on the moon, but it's more than likely we won't actually do most of that, and much of what we will do probably hasn't even been thought of yet. As for Mars, well... Dear Cheap Astronomy, are we really not going to Mars in the 2030s? Well, probably not. NASA's moving target is now 2037. It was previously 2033 until an independent review looked at their current plan and said no way, and also said no way to the next launch window in 2035, so it's 2037 now, which Cheap Astronomy guesses will be pushed into 2040 in about 3 years. China is talking about launching Taikonauts to Mars in the 2033 launch window, but without a lot of details on how, excepting some hints that they might use nuclear technologies, at least for power, if not propulsion. NASA's 2037 plan is to launch astronauts from Earth in the Space Launch System and Orion capsule combo, the Orion capsule then docking with the planned Lunar Gateway space station, where the crew will then transfer over to the DST, the Deep Space Transport Vehicle, which will take them to Mars and back again. That independent review's main concern was that prototype testing of the DST really needed to start next year to make a 2033 launch. For China's proposed 2033 launch, it's possible their less transparent space agency is already building lots of exciting new spacecraft behind closed doors, but that's just possible, not likely. At this point in history, it's highly unlikely that any government or private company is going to invest the hundreds of billions of dollars required to get humans to Mars and back again when the chances of failure and crew mortality are as high as they currently are. Current propulsion technologies means a human-crewed Mars mission will take at least 2 years, and if they wanted to stay at Mars for more than a quick flag plant, the mission will be more like 3 years. Either way, 2 or 3 years is ample opportunity for all sorts of things to go wrong on a mission where you have to take everything you need with you. And apart from the mission infrastructure deteriorating over time, the astronauts' health will also deteriorate over time due to the effects of microgravity and also exposure to cosmic rays. There are theoretical solutions to these issues, but such solutions are barely on the drawing board, let alone flight tested, and would require a radical departure from any spacecraft designs that are currently in production. Details are sketchy on NASA's Deep Space Transport Vehicle, but it certainly won't have rotation-induced gravity. At the moment, it's looking like an Orion capsule with a larger inflatable habitat module attached. It seems to be the case that the Mars-bound astronauts or get by much as astronauts on the International Space Station do. That is, they'll do lots of exercise to counter the musculoskeletal and cardiovascular effects of microgravity, although all the exercise may not help with other effects of microgravity, for example, its effect on visual acuity. The Chief Astronomy Research Department couldn't find any details on enhanced radiation shielding. The standard Orion capsule has a radiation sensor intended to detect a burst of increased radiation, such as from a solar flare. The crew are then meant to huddle together, surrounding themselves with stowage bags, to create a makeshift shelter. There's talk of a more permanent emergency retreat compartment planned for the Mars DST, but none of this thinking deals with the constant background of the generally more harmful galactic cosmic rays. So, you do have to wonder whether the agencies saying they will go to Mars in the 2030s really believe it themselves. NASA has a number of web pages covering a range of issues needed for a Mars mission that aren't obviously part of the 2037 mission plan. For example, the use of nuclear thermal propulsion and nuclear fission generators that will maintain power on the global dust storm-prone Martian surface. These are very sensible ideas that the Chinese may be considering also. Other even less talked about parts of the mission are the Martian lander, along with the key issue of how it will carry sufficient fuel to both manage the landing and the subsequent launch back. Landing along with its launch fuel doesn't seem physically possible because it's just too much mass, and the best current proposed solution is to source fuel from Mars itself. So, yes, we could go to Mars in the 2030s and maybe even land there. Whether we could take off again is another question, and what kind of shape the astronauts might be at the end of such a mission is yet another question. Of course, a whole lot of development can be achieved in the next 16 years, but only so much.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. It's very likely we'll be back to the moon within the next decade, and hopefully with a salient plan to do something useful, and we'll be off to Mars whenever we have the technological capability not to make it a suicide mission. And hopefully we'll have some kind of salient plan for what the heck we do there. In the meantime, let's remember, there is no Planet B. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a death wish, or you just want to assess your capability for it, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll try to keep your feet on the ground. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.